This is Bruce Friedman of Adult Site Broker, and welcome to Adult Site Broker Talk, where each week we interview one of the movers and shakers of the adult industry, and we give you a tip on buying and selling websites. This week we'll be speaking with Alex Georges of LustLab AI. Would you like an easy way to make a lot of money? Send sellers or buyers to us at Adult Site Broker through our affiliate program, ASB Cash. When you refer business to us, you'll receive 20% of our broker commission on all sales that result from that referral for life. You can make $100,000 or more on only one sale for some of our listings. Check out asbcash.com for more details and to sign up. At Adult Site Broker, we're proud to announce our latest project, the WarOnPorn.com. You'll find articles from industry websites as well as mainstream publications from around the world. It's designed to raise awareness of our industry's plight in the war on porn and the numerous attacks on our industry and online free speech by hate groups, the religious right, and politicians. You'll find all that and more at the WarOnPorn.com. We've also added an events section to our website at adultsitebroker.com. Now you can get information on B2B events on our site, as well as special discounts reserved for our clients. Go to adultsitebroker.com for more details. Now let's feature our property of the week that's for sale at Adult Site Broker. We're proud to introduce a successful and growing OnlyFans agency. They've been in business less than a year and a half, but they've experienced tremendous growth. The company was founded by two brothers. In the last year, they've done over $5 million in gross profit. They have over 130 full-time Filipino employees with affordable salaries. The strategy of the company is to acquire large volumes of creators, put them through their automated onboarding process, and then they decide which creators are worth keeping. Out of over 2,000 in the last year, they pared down to the 300-plus creators they have now. They focus on 30 to 50 high-revenue-producing creators. The top one is generating $120,000 in monthly revenue. There are many high-potential creators who currently do between $5,000 to $75,000 a month. These creators can be scaled through detailed focus and know-how, not to mention additional marketing. The founders have created scalable systems and automations through sustainable processes. The whole company is very well structured. The founders currently only work about an hour a day due to their systems. There's a great potential to further develop the revenue from each creator, thus multiplying the revenue and profits of the company. The main marketing is TikTok, with some Instagram sprinkled in, which leaves amazing opportunities using other media and buying ads. Only $13.5 million. Now time for this week's interview. My guest today on Adult Site Broker Talk is Alex Georges of LustLab. Hey, Alex, thanks for being with us on Adult Site Broker Talk.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. Alex's journey into tech began 15 years ago in particle physics, a field known for pioneering the web. He expanded his expertise with a PhD in physics, with all of his research centered on AI. From teaching computers to seem more like humans, to constructing a mathematical framework for computer-based problem solving, akin to human reasoning, Alex gained a deep understanding of AI's capabilities and also its limitations. Transitioning from academia, he moved to corporate strategy at Boston Consulting Group, where he primarily priced popcorn. Got to hear about that. He also worked on deep tech strategies across various industries, where he was applying complex AI concepts to real-world business problems, providing valuable insights into strategic decision-making. His journey continued as an AI engineer at the crypto firm Gemini, where he was instrumental in building high-performance AI systems for consumer tech, learning about applying AI in fast-paced, innovative environments. Today, Alex is the driving force behind LustLab, a cutting-edge AI company in the adult content industry. Beyond the tech world, he enjoys surfing, boxing, and drumming in a band, embracing a well-rounded life. Lust Lab was established in mid-2023, all the way back then. They just rolled out their latest product a few weeks ago, actively resolving kinks here and there, but of course not those kind. Explore their website at lustlab.ai, and you can share your feedback with Alex. While their platform currently focuses on images, they have exciting plans to expand into video, sexting, and audio content. Their core philosophy revolves around collaborating with content creators rather than replacing them. They're building operational tools to enhance creators' work. They're committed to promoting ethical content creation and responsible consumption. Alex encourages people to reach out to him with any questions or ideas. So, Alex, what is AI and how does it differ from traditional computing methods?
Yeah. So thanks so much for the intro. That was very, very good.
Wasn't easy. Go.
No, so it's a great question, too. And I think there's a lot of fear surrounding AI as well, just because, you know, people don't really understand what it is and what its limitations are. So getting back to your question, the traditional computing, it's very instruction based. It's like you tell the computer exactly, okay, this is the instruction set for what exactly we want you to do. AI is a little bit different. And I'm going to give two levels of answers here, kind of the abstract answer, and then I'll give an analogy. So the abstract answer is that AI is kind of like a mathematical framework where you tell the computer, here's how you think about the world. And given that framework, you then show it data and you say, okay, we've told you how to think about the world. Here is data. Go learn what you can from it. And so that's kind of the abstract way of thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And to give a specific analogy, let's say there's an artist out there that we need to teach how to paint. The conventional method, like let's say we're just comparing back to what I just said. The conventional method would be to go to the artist and we would say, hey, to paint this portrait of this ocean, you first pick up the paintbrush, then you dip it in the blue paint, and then these are the exact strokes that you make, and, you know, etc. So it's very instruction based. The AI way of teaching the artist would be to say, okay, here's all these landscape photos. You know, here's some of the ocean over here. Here's some of mountains. Go learn how to paint just by looking at them. It's a very different paradigm, but it's all kind of a mathematical framework, so to speak, that lets us kind of shift. So hopefully that made sense, but it's just a way to teach computers how to think about the world.
Interesting. Now, can you explain generative AI and its potential to transform industries?
Certainly. So just going back to that example right there, let's say generative AI is a specific class of artificial intelligence. And what we mean by generative AI, and you'll hear it referred to as gen AI. So it's a specific class, and that class of AI generates its own content. It's typically media content. So it's AI that generates, you know, images, video, audio, text, you name it kind of thing. And the way that we teach it is exactly that artist analogy. So we show it thousands upon thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of images. Let's say we have a generative AI for images. So this AI is responsible for producing images. The way that we teach it about the world is we have all these potentially millions of images, and we, you know, hand it a photo of a beach and we say, hey, this is what a beach looks like. Then we hand it a photo of a person and then we say, hey, this is what a person looks like. And we repeat that process over and over and over. And then eventually, you know, we stop that. And eventually we can ask the generative AI, hey, go draw a beach for me. And the distinction here is that generative AI system will make something completely new that has never been seen before. It'll be based on its past learning experience. And again, this is very similar to that analogy for the artist, where, you know, an artist, when they're going through their prep school or whatever it is, they've seen, you know, thousands upon thousands of different artworks that are probably inspired by them. But at the end of the day, you know, they're able to learn from those and then generate their own creative work. So generative AI is kind of doing that same exact thing. Just we've told computers, here's how to do the creative process.
Okay. So the name makes sense, generative.
Yeah, exactly.
In what ways do you see generative AI impacting our daily lives And where do you draw the line between human creativity and AI assistance?
Yeah, that's another good question.
Well, that's because I asked it.
Yeah. Makes sense. So I see generative AI taking place in our lives kind of like a little personal assistant. So I'm going to keep going back to this analogy of like AI is just a framework that we tell a computer how to understand a very specific, a very hyper-specific part of the world. They're not all-knowing. They're very good at very hyper-specific tasks. And getting back to your question, the way that I see generative AI impacting our daily lives is that it will start to take the place of kind of like little assistants. So we could have a generative AI that helps us plan our day. We could have a generative AI that helps us, you know, come up with some creative ideas for our work. We can have a generative AI that creates the music that we listen to throughout the day. And I think there's going to be these very specific use cases. Again, I'm stressing the point of hyper-specificity because it's not like there's a single AI out there that's going to be doing everything. It's all these amalgamated tools that are going to come into our lives. And your question on human creativity. So I think what I just said might be scary to some people because they're like, oh, you know, this is going to be taking over the world. I personally don't see it that way. I do understand the fear there. But the way that I see it is that these are just tools. They're operational tools that have the possibility of enhancing our lives. They have the possibility of positively impacting our lives. They could also certainly negatively impact our lives, depending on how we as humans implement them into our workflows. But I see them not as replacements for things. I see them as just more tools, you know, just as much as how, you know, the internet or any tech innovation of the last 40 years has been a tool in our lives. And, you know, not all of those innovations have been positive by and large, but, you know, some of them have. And I think the same exact thing is true with generative AI.
But don't you expect AI to take over a lot of jobs?
Yes and no. And I think what I'm about to say is a similar answer to that argument throughout time. Like when a new technological innovation comes out, I think it has the potential to replace jobs anyway. So I'm just making the point that generative AI is not unique here. But what I think is going to happen is that it will take over some jobs, but it'll also create other jobs. And it might be that, let's say rather than, you know, let's say there's people who do blogging as a living, you know, they're only bloggers, whatever. And, you know, up until a few years ago, they were obviously doing that all from the creativity of their brain. And there's two ways that that could go. One is that they could be out of a job because now there's all this AI content being generated to blog, or they could use it as a tool to make even better blogs than they would have before, because they still have all that creativity in their brain and they could still potentially wield that generative AI to do bigger and better things that they ever could have before. I think the answer is yes and no to your point of will it take over jobs. I think it will shift things. And I think the jury is still out on whether or not that shift will be, by and large, a positive impact. I'm hopeful that it will be. But, you know, I've chatted with other people that are just pure afraid. And they're like, there's no way that humans are going to be responsible here. My viewpoint is that it will turn out for the better.
One will hope. And it's a good time to ask this question. So with the rapid advancement of AI, what are some potential dangers society should be aware of? And what fears do you find to be a bit exaggerated?
So on the, I'll start with the second part there. So on the exaggerated piece, it's kind of going back to something that I was saying earlier, where like these AI systems are still very hyper-specific. They require so much hand-holding from humans. Like one of the fears that I hear a lot, you know, is just that they're going to like run our lives. They're going to like take over. They're going to, I'm just thinking of like Terminator type of stuff. And to me that, you know, that's potentially a possibility, but it's a very long-term possibility. Again, because there's so much handholding that we do with the AI. And to give an example, so when I was in grad school, the bulk of my research was on computer vision, which is basically, think of like a Tesla going down the street. And, you know, the question is, how does it understand what's around it? Well, it's using something called computer vision.
The answer is often it doesn't, and, from what I've heard.
Yeah. No, it doesn't is the answer. But when it does, then, you know, the thing that's running that process is computer vision. And actually, to your point, it's very easy to trick them. despite seeing hundreds of millions of pictures of clouds versus white cars, it can still confuse them. And during my research in grad school, I studied that phenomenon.
That's extremely scary.
It is. You know, that example that I just gave, I do think that that is a real example that happened in real life. I don't know the outcome of it. I think the person was injured or it was a fatal accident. I don't want to misspeak here. But the point is that the closer I get to AI, the more I realize how stupid it is. And, you know, as it's hyper good at very specific things. But that fear of, oh, they're going to take over everything, it doesn't bother me because I just realize how dumb they are by and large, despite how amazing their output is. Like if we're looking at what OpenAI is doing, I am still amazed by what it's doing, but I'm acutely aware of all the limitations that they have.
I mean, I don't use AI near as much as I should, but I definitely use ChatGPT to rewrite my press releases for 8 different media. So they're not the same press release for everybody. I still need to get that prompt exactly right. Maybe you can help me with that. But I'll tell you, it works really well. And in fact, I had an AI that I was paying for before, and it didn't do near as good as ChatGPT does.
Oh, yeah. No, for sure. And, you know, to be honest, this isn't even Alex speaking. This is an AI version of Alex that you're talking to right now. For anybody out there who wants to check this out, there's this really cool company called 11 Labs who do an amazing job at vocal replication. So, you know, you can take my voice from this call, put it through 11 Labs, and then have Alex out in the world saying whatever. Not that I'm advocating for that. So, and then there was another interesting point that you made there, which is like, what are the fears given the rapid advancements? And I do have some very specific fears here. And they're specific to generative AI and largely like what you were just saying with ChatGPT. Not ChatGPT specifically, just generative AI. So in the past few years, there's been this movement towards open source AI. And what that means is that people can take large language models, kind of like a ChatGPT. They can take that AI, they can download it to their computer, they can show it their own data, whatever data that they want. And then it teaches the AI to think differently about the world. And then that person can take that AI and plop it back online for anybody to grab. And there's little to no tracking mechanism to understand these little tweaks and how this generative AI basically is propagating throughout time. What that means is that me as a nefarious person, I could take an AI, you know, ChatGPT equivalent, I could pull it down, I could show it propaganda that only shows up in very specific use cases. And if I put it back online, that could do some real damage. People could be using that AI and then, you know, they type in something about World War II and then all of a sudden it triggers the misinformation propaganda. And because this space is moving so quickly, people are just fueled by this coolness factor of what can we do that's cool? How can we productize it? And to be fair, there are some people that are thinking about how can we make it safe and positive, but it's moving a little bit too quickly for people to really come up with plans here. So that is one of my fears, is that there could be very harmful impacts of generative AI that leak out into society because there's not a good way of tracking how these things think about the world. One last thing that I'll say here. If anybody is interested in this, I do have a blog where I go into like very specific tech details here. So, you know, feel free to jump into that.
Okay. So deepfakes have garnered significant attention recently. Could you elaborate on what they are and their broader implications for society and personal privacy?
Yeah, certainly. Deepfakes are a technology. They've been around for a while, I think since 2017. They've been coming up in the news recently. They've been around for a bit. And what it is it's a technology that allows you to take the likeness of somebody and make them do or say something that they didn't actually do. You know, that can be in images, that can be in video, that can be in audio, that can be in written word. The example that I gave of 11 Labs and somebody taking my voice and doing whatever with it, that would be a deepfake. And you know, they have garnered basically only negative press recently, but I want to make the distinction that, again, all this stuff in my mind is just a technology, and it's how people are using it that determines whether it's positive or negative. And deepfakes, I do think, have a positive side to them. And I realized this just recently when I was deepfaking myself to come up with AI versions of myself. And it was pretty amazing and eye-opening. And I have another blog on this. But I do think that it can be used in a positive mental health way, actually, you know, to be able to see yourself in different situations. Let's say you have body dysmorphia or whatever. And again, I'm not a mental health expert here. It's just, so don't take my word for any of this. But to be able to say, Alex, I want to see what you look like as this person or that person or in this environment or looking like this, I think there's a big thing to say there for like how that could be a positive impact for self-acceptance. And another thing that I came across for a use case, and this was not my idea, was for grief counseling. So being able to potentially reconnect with a loved one that's passed away. Again, I think there are some people that this would be positive for, some people that it would not be positive for. So I'm just pointing out that deepfakes aren't, there's nothing inherently evil to them. They're a technology.
Again, it's how it's used. It's like any technology and anything. If you use it positively, it's a positive. If you use it negatively, it's a negative.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And they've been negative recently, specifically because they're being used for non-consensual deepfaking, taking a celebrity's image and putting them in nude, whatever. They didn't give consent.
I think they did that with Taylor Swift, if I'm not mistaken. They put her in a porn movie.
Yeah, yeah, that's who I was hinting at there. But yeah, it's, there's the bad use case of it. So it is a double-edged sword.
Well, as a 49er fan, we're recording this just less than a week after the Super Bowl. I don't mind that at all. A little sick of her. Somebody suggested that I follow her on Twitter, and I took a screenshot of that and I posted, "Not if you put a gun to my head." So how do you see the role of ethics in AI development, especially concerning generative AI?
There's a lot to unpack there, and I'll try to make this shorter rather than longer. So in the first place, I think it's absolutely necessary. And, you know, going back to the point of like one of my fears of, you know, people recycling these AIs, doing whatever they want with them, addressing that issue is addressing an ethical concern to me. In the first place, I think this is absolutely necessary that we do this. And again, to be fair, there are many people out there that are doing this, that do ethical AI research, that do some of the things that I'm talking about. But I'd like to see it be done more, is what I'm saying. And in the second place, it's hard for two reasons. One, because we as a society need to decide this is okay, this is not okay for AI as it, you know, impacts our lives. And it's also hard because, you know, let's say we have all those rules in place saying this is exactly how we want the AI to be in our lives. It's hard from a tech perspective to narrowly scope these systems to be like, okay, this is exactly how we need you to perform in all these scenarios. So, you know, it's a hard problem, I'll say. But to be a little bit more constructive here, I'd say that in the near future, there's two main things that we need to do. One of them is to have more data policies. And the data here is both upstream and downstream. So on the upstream side, it is like, you know, what data do we show our AIs? And having a much clearer picture there and saying, you know, it's not okay to show the AI copyrighted data. So you need to license the data in order to show it. Like those are all upstream data policies. Like when we're showing the AI the world, what can we show it? That's the upstream stuff. The downstream stuff is after we've shown the AI about the world, what can we do with the content that's produced with the AI? And again, I think there's very little policies there. So, you know, if we produce images or we produce audio or we produce video, what can and can't that be used for? That's one thing. And another thing is, you know, making sure that consumers can distinguish, okay, this was AI generated or this was human generated. So having that, I think that there's a strong case for how that will protect consumers, being able to distinguish who their content came from. And, you know, all those data policies are being talked about in the EU a little bit more, I believe. They just passed something called the EU AI Act in December of last year. So, and, you know, they're talking about these things a little bit more. I do think that there's more room to improve. And the last thing that I'll say here is that the other ethical piece is tracking the AI. So the pieces to the AI is, okay, what do we do with the data around it? And then what do we do with the AI itself? And we need a way to track the AIs. We need to be able to say, okay, this AI from this company thinks this way. And throughout time, it's evolved to think, you know, in these other ways. So it's going back to the point that I was bringing up about, okay, we could slip in propaganda into the AI. And if we don't have a way of saying, okay, this is largely how the AI thinks about the world, then things go to shit, basically. So I'm just advocating for being able to track how these things think about the world.
Sure. Don't expect anything good out of the U.S. Congress anytime soon, because it's pretty obvious those guys don't understand tech in any way, shape, or form. So especially the more senior members, God knows. What are the most exciting advancements in AI that you're looking forward to, and how might they impact the future of content creation?
Yeah, so if you asked me this question yesterday, it would have changed from today. Because just last night, OpenAI produced a new AI system called Sora, S-O-R-A, that does video generation damn good. So you can type in lady walking down the street in Thailand wearing leather jacket or whatever, and then the AI will generate that scene for you. There's no audio currently.
Open, you're talking about OpenAI?
Yeah, OpenAI.
Wow.
So yeah, so they just launched that last night. And one of the most exciting things for me is having that video get better. So prior to yesterday, the video generation was an available technology, but it was shitty. You would type in what I just said, and it would be a 3-second GIF, and it would be a shit GIF. But what OpenAI just did is they made it about a minute long video, or a minute or two, something like that. And the quality is phenomenal. So the next steps there, you know, one of the most exciting things for me there is, okay, rather than a minute, let's get it to 3 minutes or to 6 minutes or like to whatever format, and then to also put in audio. So, you know, having great quality video generation from AI is still one of the most exciting things, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I heard they were coming out with a new version. I didn't realize they had taken that step. So that's great. So give us a brief overview of what LustLab is and the core mission driving your company.
LustLab, we're in the generative AI space, if you couldn't already guess. Ultimately, there's so many ways of saying what we do as a platform, but one of the ways of thinking about it is ultimate personalization in adult entertainment. We want to build a product that fosters sexual exploration in a positive and meaningful way while trying to take the stigma off of it. My background is in pure tech, and then I hopped into this industry, and there's been so many challenges along the way. Things that, this is going to be a little bit tangenty. There's been so many challenges along the way that I think it's just weird to me how much of humans turn a blind eye towards sex, given how big of a part of our lives it is what I'm trying to say. And, you know, like you said in the beginning, we're all about ethical creation and consumption. There's a lot to unpack there, but I want this to be a positive product for people. I want this to not play into people's addictions if they have them. Or, you know, there's all these things to think about. And we're starting out direct to consumer. So basically, you can go onto our website, lustlab.ai, and currently images only, but we are, you know, we're working on video and we're going to be rolling that out soon. But high quality images. So you can go onto our website, you can say, I'm interested in gay interactions or trans female, or I'm interested in hentai. And you can type in whatever you want. So give me a photo of blah. And we output a super high quality photo. And it, to me, it's truly amazing, the quality that we're getting. And soon we'll be transitioning to partnering with content creators. And that's where I think we're going to be making the most impact. Sorry, this is a little bit tangential to your question of the mission, but the mission more or less is, you know, positive platform for sexual exploration focused on ethics, ethical creation and consumption, and also creating a sustainable business. You know, I don't mean to smear competitors in this space because a lot of them are doing such amazing things, but by and large, they're focusing on quick wins. Like, how can we build the quickest thing, launch it, get a quick buck? We might not be around tomorrow, but good for them. That's not what we're about. We're about sustainability. Sustainability from the tech perspective, sustainability from the business infrastructure perspective.
Okay. So I was reading your resume earlier. I mean, advanced degree, academia, corporate America, adult. And I'm sure everybody has the same question that's listening to this. Why adult?
Yeah, it's definitely a pivot for me. There's a number of reasons there. So this started last year when one of my ex-colleagues, you know, he's also a tech person, and he came up to me and he's like, hey, let's make AI porn, is his words, I think. And it immediately struck me as, yes, let's do that. That is going to have so much impact. And it's a cool tech problem, too. You know, it just hit me right away. Like, yeah, that let's do it. And, you know, it's that's still what I think about it. You know, initially the impact piece was, oh, I think consumers are really going to like it. Mm. But the impact has transformed more into, I truly think that there are positive impacts that we can make on people with this product. And, you know, happy to get into what those are. But basically, the initial genesis into this was that conversation being like, oh, yeah, that is an awesome tech problem and it's going to be impactful. And to me, I see what we're building as a tech company, not an adult company. It just so happens that we're applying our tech to adult. But the tech that we're building is modular, and the problems that we're solving in the tech are going to be, you know, movable elsewhere. So I really see us doing a tech company that happened to be an adult because of the impact. Even though it might appear like a pivot from the outside, I don't really see it that way. I'm still building a tech company.
Okay. Makes sense. What sets Lust Lab apart from other players in the adult content and AI industries? Kind of alluded to some of it. Maybe you can get into more detail. And how are you leveraging AI?
Yeah, certainly. Like you said, we already touched on some of them, but if I were to distill it, I'd say quality, ethics, and sustainability would be the top three differentiators. The quality, go to people out there and then compare to us. And I think it will speak for itself there. And it's not an easy thing to do, to create seemingly completely real interactions between people. You know, part of the way that we're able to do that is we have an amazing team. Like, we have a few PhDs on our team from machine learning. You know, we have data officers from other companies. Like, we have an amazing team, and that all can be seen in the quality of the product. So that's the first piece. The second piece is the ethics, which I've literally heard no other competitor talking about. And it is such an important piece to me. And I break it down into ethical creation and consumption. The creation piece is licensing. It's all the upstream data stuff that we were talking about. So how, you know, we don't scrape data. We instead license our data. You know, so that's one piece there. Another piece is when we start to partner more with content creators, I see them as business partners, you know. So I want there to be, you know, a win-win situation for both of us, basically. So there's all that ethics on the upstream stuff. And then on the downstream data as well, we are doing things like invisible watermarking. We're making it so that if our media propagates into the world, then somebody will be able to, you know, say, okay, no, that was from Lust Lab, because embedded in the metadata, it says it. So that's on the ethics creation piece. And then on the consumption piece, like I said, I want this to be a positive experience for people. And eventually, we're going to get into a choose your own adventure kind of experience. And there's a lot to be done there in terms of the positivity. And one of the things that we're doing is we're partnering with a sex psychologist who specializes in sex addiction and young males. And just having her input is super helpful, because I don't want this to play into addictive behavior of people. I want this to be positive. So, you know, that's all in the ethics, creation and consumption piece. And then the last thing that I'll say here is on the sustainability piece. So we are creating a sustainable business. You know, it's going to be around, the hope is that it will be around for quite a long time. We're not just grabbing an existing tech off the shelf and plopping it on a website like some other people are doing. We're building in-house our tech. We're coming up with our own policies in-house. Some people are using very questionable payment stacks for their website. You know, that's not us. I want us to be around for quite a while. And that's important for the end user because, you know, people don't want to give their money to a product that in a few days is going to go down. And so, sorry, one last thing that I'll say here is that on the tech side, I think there was a question along the lines of how are we leveraging AI? And the way that we're doing that plays into all of these three differentiating factors. You know, when you go onto our website and you type in, give me a picture of blank, that prompt doesn't go to just a single AI. It goes to literally about 20 different systems, some of which are pure AI, some of which are just more heuristic based. But it goes to all of these systems. So there's an upstream quality checker. Then midstream, you generate the content. Then downstream, there's another quality control checker. So these are things that the competitors are not doing. They are doing the middle piece, the midstream create content, but they're not doing this quality control upstream and downstream. And that quality control is absolutely necessary for coming up with a positive product. Because we don't want to advocate for rape, for instance. So we need to ban that as good as possible. So we have all these systems in place to kind of restrict the usage.
Okay. What have been some of the hardest challenges you've had to solve with LessLab?
There's been a lot. So what we're building is a state-of-the-art tech product.
Right.
And what comes with that are significant compute costs. So to run these AI systems, they're expensive. And we're a completely bootstrapped company, which means no investors have, you know, given us money yet, despite us asking around. It's by and large a very hard space to get investment money in. And we have a lot of compute costs, probably more so than some other adult companies out there. So it's this weird setup of like, we're trying to be state-of-the-art and innovative, but we need to do so at the lowest cost possible. And it's, you know, like, what can we do with a penny rather than the $10 million that a mainstream AI person is doing. So one of the biggest things is just dealing with that, like running a company for a state-of-the-art product at zero investment money. So that's been one of the challenges. We've done amazingly well. And the way that we've been able to do it is that as of today, everybody is running on pure sweat equity. So they have equity in the company, all the people that I work with, because we still don't have like the salary money to pay people. But the point is that everybody is so bought into the vision that yes, LessLab is going to be the next big thing. And you know, I've been so grateful to work with my current employees. So, and then in terms of the compute costs, there's other like little scrappy things that we've done. Like we're not currently running on the most optimal system to produce the fastest media, but it's what we need to do for the time being. Yeah, it's just been dealing with the cost constraints, given specifically the state-of-the-art product.
Okay, makes sense. Now, what are some lessons you've learned on this journey that might be helpful to others considering a startup in tech or adult?
The first lesson is that it's extremely easy. Just jump into it, and it'll be a breeze. No, I'm kidding. It's the exact opposite. One of the main lessons that I found is getting a good support network around me, specifically of entrepreneurs, because there's so much learning that I do every day. And it, you know, the entrepreneur network is good for just dealing with emotional overwhelm. Like, you know, some mornings I wake up and I'm like, okay, what shit do I have to deal with today? And, you know, sometimes it's very scary. And, you know, I'm a first-time entrepreneur. So, you know, some entrepreneurs out there might be listening to this and then they'll be thinking, okay, yeah, this guy's an idiot. Of course, having a support network is good. But it's been a lot of learning there on just like how stressful and anxiety-producing building a company can be, but also at the same time how, you know, impactful it can be. Like, this is, to an extent, my dream job. It's a very challenging one, but it's been amazing. And in terms of building an AI company, I'd say if you're an AI, don't go into an adult. It's hard unless you're like me.
You've got hopefully the rewards on the other end. And isn't that what you count on?
It is to an extent. I also try to not buy into that argument so much and be like, and enjoy the process along the way. And the enjoyment that I get out of the current process is the learning. And sometimes that learning can be painful. It can be shit, I handled that people management situation entirely wrong. Like I did a bad mistake, and that can be painful. But at the same time, it's a learning experience. And that's something that I really value as a person is being able to learn. So it's both enjoyable and challenging at the same time. So yes, you're right that at the other side of it, there might be a day where I'm able to hand this off and be like, okay, that was amazing, on to my next venture. But I'm also trying to enjoy the day by day.
Sure. And you obviously enjoy what you do. How do you balance the technical and creative aspects of running LessLab?
I don't know. I still haven't solved that one. I'll get back to you in a few years. Let's see. It's this weird combination of, because I'm building the business, which is a lot of business building, but I'm also still building the product, which is deep divey, like pure code days. And there's a lot of this zooming out and zooming in. And it's the same thing for the creativity. So the creativity requires me to zoom out a little bit. The AI requires me to zoom in. And it's this constant zooming in and zooming out, which is challenging. It is extremely challenging. And the way that I do that, I mean, I just have systems in place. You know, I do some intense time blocking to be like, okay, you only have 2 hours to do this AI. Then you need to switch to this next thing. So there's these little strategies like that. Another is exercise. I'm a big advocate of exercise. So boxing, surfing helps me zoom out and like be more flexible in that mindset. And then the other is I rely on other people. I'm not afraid to ask for help. And I think that's a good skill set for an entrepreneur to have, is reaching out to other people for guidance, say, hey, look, I need help doing blah, and not being ashamed of whatever issue. And I also rely on, entrepreneurs, my advisor network, just to help guide me through things. So, you know, a lot of the times my issue is being stuck in the zoomed in mode and I can't zoom out. So my network helps me zoom out. They help me see the broader picture. So I think it's those three things.
Nice. Yeah, I've found over the years that it's important to delegate. You can't do everything yourself. I have my set of subcontractors who I work with. And then I've also got my advisors, and I've got people that are kind enough to take their time to say, hey, Bruce, this is what I would do. And when you've been in an industry like this, like I have for going on a quarter century, you know a lot of people and you know who to talk to. Yeah. So, I mean, it definitely helps. And I always extend my network to others as well, because that's the way the world should go around anyway.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, hey, Alex, I'd like to thank you for being our guest today on AdultSide Broker Talk. And I look forward to doing this again as LessLab continues on.
Thanks so much, Bruce. It was a pleasure.
My pleasure.
My broker tip today is part 4 of what to do to make your site more valuable for when you decide to sell it later. Last week, we talked about keeping your site up to date and making sure everything works. Next, find new ways to monetize your website, such as sell advertising. If you've got a free site like a tube, that's the best way to monetize your site. If you have a tube, another way to make more money is to sell premium memberships. Offer free users one level of content, and for premium users, you can do things like give them higher quality or longer videos or both. You can also make the site ad-free for premium members. Start an affiliate program. If you have a pay site, this is a great way to increase your quality of traffic and get more joins. With all sites, you can figure out other upgrades and products you can sell to your users. Pay sites can also sell pay-per-view, where people have the option of paying by the scene for content they can't get on the site. This is also another way to charge users as opposed to a monthly fee. Sell them other products like toys and novelties. Market your business. Do things to improve your search engine results. There are some great SEO consultants out there who can help you get higher search rankings in Google. If you want some recommendations, contact us on our site. List all the benefits of your site in your marketing and how they affect the user. And of course, hire a great marketing consulting firm such as Adult B2B Marketing, which we also happen to own. We'll talk about this subject more next week. And next week, we'll be speaking with Morgan Goes Wild. And that's it for this week's Adult Site Broker Talk. I'd once again like to thank my guest, Alex Georges of Lust Lab AI. Talk to you again next week on Adult Site Broker Talk. I'm Bruce Friedman.